Aloha and welcome to the Startup Catalyst podcast, produced by Sultan Ventures. I'm your host, Yasmeen Dar. This season, we'll hear insights from minority and women entrepreneurs and investors and how they're striving to make a difference. Today's guest is Rodney Sampson, a serial entrepreneur, author, and founder of Opportunity Hub. In today's episode, we'll hear what sparked Rodney's entrepreneurial career, why he got into investing, and how he's promoting inclusivity and making a difference from Atlanta, Georgia. Support for the Startup Catalyst comes from American Savings Bank, dedicated to supporting innovative ideas and entrepreneurial solutions in Hawaii. Visit asbhawaii.com, Equal Housing Lender, member FDIC. Rodney, thank you so much for taking the time to spend with us here on our podcast. For those of our audience members who don't know who Rodney Sampson is, can you give us a little elevator pitch on who you are and what your mission is?
Sure. So I'm Rodney Sampson, chairman and CEO of the Opportunity Hub. And our macro mission is to disrupt poverty and the racial wealth gap by ensuring that underrepresented, underestimated, undersponsored, socially disadvantaged communities have full access to the innovation, tech, entrepreneurship, startup, and investment wealth creation ecosystem. I know that's a lot, but
it's very specific. And yeah. I think that's really important as well, though.
Yeah. I mean, to that point, so Duke University recently released a study suggesting what we all get wrong as it relates to closing the racial wealth gap. And you read it, it can be pretty discouraging, but there's a lot of truth in it. And so what we've realized is we have to focus on individual multi-generational wealth creation. And then hopefully over time, that will have some aggregate impact. The study is talking about aggregate closure of the racial wealth gap. And we've had some success, whether it be personally or from the people that we've served over the last 6+ years, helping them close the racial wealth gap, but we've got a ways to go.
Congratulations. I know it's no easy feat. And, you know, we've spoken to a bunch of people here on this podcast regarding that. And a lot of them obviously will say that this goes back to history, where they just never had the opportunities other racial classes had. And, you know, I know you're really busy. Congratulations. You're recently named a senior fellow at Brookings Institute. You're expanding on Opportunity Hub or OHUB. What are you folks doing there right now? And explain to us what Opportunity Hub is as well.
Well, today we consider ourselves to be an inclusive innovation, entrepreneurship, and investment ecosystem building platform. You know, in our world, you know, essentially where Tariq and I met, it was at an ecosystem building conference, right? So as the world starts to look at ecosystem building as the future of economic development or net new job creation, I thought it was important that it be as inclusive as possible. It is the future of opportunity. And so you have to look at how our business has evolved or our work has evolved over the last 6 years. When we launched Opportunity Hub, it started as a response to our own customer discovery to the attendees of our Kingonomics conference. And so in 2012, I completed and then released in early 2013, my fourth book entitled Kingonomics, 12 Innovative Currencies for Transforming Your Business and Life, inspired by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And so I literally spent 2 years of my life researching Dr. King's works, his speeches, his sermons, his talks and recordings, and settled on a thesis that in his final years in particular, he was focused not just on civil and human dignity, but economic dignity. And with that, you would hear Dr. King talk about cooperative economics and collaborative economics and pooling Black spending power. And so out of that came my interpretation of Dr. King's ideals as it relates to economics, and that's how this Kingonomics movement was born. And so simultaneously, just to give you some, I guess, historical context, I had also just recently accepted a position with Mark Burnett Productions as the head of diversity and inclusion, and Shark Tank was the major property that I worked on. And so we would have our Kingonomics conferences in tandem with the Shark Tank casting calls. Even one time or twice, we had some of the sharks. We had Mark Cuban and Damon in D.C. We had Damon in Atlanta. And so that attracted a lot of people. So that was a blessing that we were able to combine those two efforts. And so we asked questions back then, well, if you had an idea and you wanted to bring it to market, what do you believe you would require? And so people would say, well, we need a safe space to work. And so what do you mean by safe space? Well, we have entrepreneurs even to this day. And I remember starting my first tech company back in 2000. It's hard enough having to build a business from nothing and from the ground up. But when you also have to deal with the nuances and microaggressions that happen in white spaces, it compounds the stress and just the overall path of being a successful or significant entrepreneur. And so we created a safe space called Opportunity Hub. Anyone who wanted to come could come and become a member, but you didn't have to worry about, you know, being asked where the restroom was or being treated like the help or being ignored at networking events or you know, being accused of stealing a laptop. You know, it's just foolishness that happens to Black entrepreneurs on the regular. And so we created that safe space, and it grew very quickly. Beyond just a safe space to work, these would-be or existing entrepreneurs said they required mentorship. So we launched our mentorship and residence program. They required technical assistance, and they weren't getting it from the traditional government organizations like SCORE, the SBA at the time, that weren't really built for the startup ecosystem or high growth, accelerated, you know, equity raising, venture raising types of product-based, software-based businesses. And so we then evolved to create a pre-accelerator, an incubator, and we started investing in companies. And so we grew very, very fast, attracting a lot of high profile people to Atlanta, like Steve Case, who championed our work. And so we became the largest majority Black owned technology hub and entrepreneurship center. That work continued when I merged parts of the business to create Tech Square Labs, which then purchased an old office depot and opened up a 25,000 square foot space near Georgia Tech and raised a $15 million venture fund. And so that continued for 2 years. And then I decided to pick up the operating role of Opportunity Hub again, because some of our national programs required attention. Our national, you know, coding scholarship program and HBCU at South by Southwest, which has become our most known program. Mm-hmm. So we have done a lot in terms of when you look at like what Tony Hsieh has done in Vegas and what Dan Gilbert has done in D.C. or in Detroit, or Steve Case in the DMV, they're billionaires. And so one would argue that, okay, where is the Black technology billionaire that is committed to ecosystem building? And we couldn't wait, right? And so we decided to launch and to bootstrap and to use the resources that we did have and had been afforded through our entrepreneurship ventures to launch and now scale Opportunity.
So currently for OHUB, how many locations do you have? Is it just one in Atlanta?
Well, currently, we don't have a location. We just leased out our building. So Tech Square Labs just leased out its building, and now we're embarking upon a new model. So I won't say that. We have our new, so we went from just a, you know, kind of hyper-local focused space to now extending our brand, our platform, our programs, products, et cetera, mm-hmm. to different locations. So we just opened our first lab at Morehouse. We are working to open up, and Morehouse is, mm-hmm. is one of the top historically Black colleges and universities in the country. And we now have about 60 chapters of Opportunity Hub forming at colleges around the country. So we have a new model of students work to launch chapters, and then they partner with the school to launch a lab, and then the lab can evolve into an academy. So basically, we're working to really decentralize and distribute what we've done in Atlanta and take it everywhere. We just signed a MOU to launch an Opportunity Hub in Jamaica. So we have a lot of interest of bringing aspects of OHUB, the successful aspects of OHUB, to other places. And that's what we're working on now. How do we productize and codify what we've done successfully over the last 6 years with Opportunity Hub and take it to other places? And I'm excited about the early traction we're getting. I mean, we're building technology. We have a new mobile app that is in its MVP stage, and we're working out a lot of the bugs and fixes now. It's called the Ecosystem Wealth app. It's in the iOS and Android store. And like I say, we literally are productizing and codifying this business.
That's incredible. I mean, just the breadth of work that you folks are doing is phenomenal. And I want to touch more about that. What are some of the ways that organizations can promote greater inclusion, greater inclusivity?
Just be human. Diversity or inclusion as a service, right? That's a thing now where companies and literally have been hiring firms for, you know, as long as I can remember and before I was born, to help them become more diverse, inclusive, mm-hmm. and equitable, mm-hmm. hopefully. You know, being born and raised in Atlanta and looking at how, you know, our civil rights movement translated to an economic rights movement for an accelerated period of time, a lot of it is just common sense, and a lot of it is just being willing to be uncomfortable and actually going to connect with other people. And to be honest with you, it's what Black people, and I talk about Black people in general because I am Black and because that is where the majority of our work is. I know every ethnicity and culture have their own nuances in terms of how you do business with them or how do you, you know, engage that respective culture. So I tend to talk about the one that I know the most about, but a lot of what I say can translate to other communities. But Black people in America have always had to figure out how to assimilate into white culture in order to just survive, many times for their life. So if we can learn it, other folks can learn it too. And so I think one, it has to be a top-down, you know, mandate. Mm-hmm. The leadership at the top has to want to be intentional about it. And everyone in the organization has to commit. You know, all the data is there that shows how, you know, when there are women on a decision-making team, how the economic output is greater when there's ethnic minorities on a decision-making team in a business. You know, the economic output is even greater. I think it's 15%+ for women and then 35%+ for ethnic minorities. So the data is there. The question is, why aren't investors, ecosystem builders, and founders intentional about manifesting what the data has suggested. If I am an LP in a fund, if I am a GP, if I'm an individual investor on a cap table, it would behoove me to make sure that my portfolio is as authentically diverse and inclusive as possible, because it increases the economic output and the potential ROI.
So would you say that the biggest challenge is understanding the cultural differences and working with them to just better the overall company, the overall product?
Yeah, I think that's a part of it, but I think we're still kind of, overcomplicating it a little bit. I think there should be, as an industry, there should be mm-hmm. a intentional over-index mandate to invest in Black and Hispanic-led companies. I mean, if you look at the differential between equality and equity, there's a really good infographic that has been floating around that shows, you know, you've got a very short person, you've got a mid-sized person, you got a tall person. Equality is giving them, you know, and they're all trying to watch a baseball game. So the tall person can already see over the fence, and the short person mm-hmm. can't see over the fence at all. They're looking through a hole, right? And if you give them all the same tools and resources, then the tall person gets taller. And the short person gets a little taller, but he still can't really see over the fence. Equity mm-hmm. actually provides the short person with more resources. So when you start talking about providing people who don't have or traditionally have not had access more resources than people who have a scarcity mindset or a protectionist right. mindset put up a guard. And that's where the problem is. So traditionally, diversity programs are underfunded. The miraculous is expected. Like, let's fix all of our diversity issues. But until the funding into diverse-led companies, funds, and programs is actually more than general market funds and programs, we won't see parity and equity in the ecosystem.
Do you feel like it's getting better, though? Do you feel like now that there's a lot more attention on inclusivity, diversity, the funding will slowly start coming a little faster? Because, I mean, we all see the numbers, but what's being done about it?
Well, let's, you all are a fund, and I'm affiliated with a fund. I'm not active in it anymore. Since I'm focused on Opportunity Hub, but I'm still the largest minority LP in the fund. So I'm increasingly, vested to make sure that the fund is successful. Mm-hmm. The number last year and the year before and the year before that ranges anywhere between 65 and 85 billion in angel and venture funding. So you know the numbers that women get. And let's be very clear, that number is, when it speaks of women, it's mostly talking about white women. Mm-hmm. When you look at how much Black women have raised, I believe there's 27, maybe 30 Black women ever that have raised, since people have been tracking, over $1 million in seed funding. So it's negligible in terms of percentage of. Is it getting better? To be quite honest with you, no, it's not. Because there's a lot of attention in a few areas, but I don't know if those areas are providing the economic output or even the platform for economic output. So you see a lot of funding for diversity conferences and conversations, but I don't see cap tables changing. And until cap tables are more equitable, then mm-hmm. there's no true economic output. It's just noise.
Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm.
And I think the funding community has to set the precedent that they want to fix this.
Absolutely. So why do you think there is such huge, large gap in the startup and venture capital industry? For example, pay gap, funding gap, leadership gap.
It's always been that way. Racism and sexism and isms, right, are America's Achilles heel. I mean, as great as we say we are and as good as we believe we are, until there's equity for everybody, then it's just all a campaign slogan. It's just all, a narrative, the same narrative, just a different day. And so you've got to look at history as the precedence, right? And so even though, we get excited about, and throughout history and antiquity, we see glimpses of hope, when there was Black Wall Street in Tulsa, or Black Wall Street in Raleigh-Durham and Auburn Avenue in Atlanta. Until, Black Wall Street in Tulsa was literally destroyed by the U.S. government. So you should look at and learn about Greenwood, Oklahoma, and how those Black men and women had built up the Greenwood community and had become incredibly successful and wealthy in Tulsa until a group of white people just got mad. And so, what we don't talk about are the big elephants in the room. And how we, most innovative spaces, for whatever reason, remain mostly white. Although there's some brilliant and amazing and genius Black people that just don't get an opportunity. Someone said, I don't know who to attribute to today, but, genius is distributed evenly, but opportunity isn't. And so that's what we're dealing with. And I think everyone wants to deflect and kind of codify what should just be common sense, but, and give it fancy terms, unconscious bias. I actually think there's more intentional bias than unconscious bias, but unconscious bias gives everyone like a pass. Oh yeah, I didn't mean to, discriminate because I didn't think about it. When I put this fund together, there was no one of color around, or I was busy raising my round. I'll come back and focus on inclusion later. And then what happens when you become a multi-billion-dollar company dealing with inclusion based issues that you could have dealt with when you were a bootstrap startup and had to close the seed round? And so we keep moving the cheese and we keep moving the cheese. Mm-hmm. So folks like myself who are champions for authentic inclusion and equity and diversity, we keep moving forward. But I've even started to turn down some opportunities because, I'm not going to be used as like your diversity, right? Or your inclusivity. Let's make sure we get some Black folks here and let's make sure that they're in the room. Mm-hmm. You want to work on scalable initiatives that will have long-term economic output, that will make things equitable, those are the types of opportunities that I'm pursuing and looking to work with companies on.
All right, we're going to take a quick break and hear a word from our sponsor. We'll be right back. Today's episode of the Startup Catalyst podcast is sponsored in part by Accelerate HI. Need help growing your business? Accelerate HI entrepreneurial workshops help you reach your potential and solve business's biggest obstacles. Scholarships up to 75% off available at acceleratehi.com. So you have exited two companies, two successful companies now. You're working on a variety of new projects that are also helping others with inclusion, helping them build their brands. And I'm sure you are a mentor too. But growing up, who was your mentor?
Well, of course, my family. I come from a family of entrepreneurs. They say one can put 1,000 and two can put 10,000. So actually, my wife and I both come from strong entrepreneurial backgrounds. I had an uncle after slavery who became a Pullman porter, and Uncle Ben is what he's known by. And so Ben Long saved his money and purchased thousands of acres of land near the University of Georgia. And so that became an entrepreneurial, you know, venture around the land, the real estate, the farming, the mining, et cetera. And so that entrepreneurial spirit has been inside of my family for generations. And so the concept or the freedom to explore and to launch a business without hesitation has always seemed like it's been just unlocked inside of my DNA, which I think, you know, everyone has it, is, you know, up to us to unlock it. So, you know, so beyond that would have been other technology entrepreneurs and advisors from really afar. You know, when I was launching Streaming Faith Multicast Media Networks in 2000, you know, I knew who Emmett McHenry was, who was the original Black founder of Network Solutions. So there were a few, you know, Omar Wassaw, these were some of my peers. It was more peer-to-peer mentorship because there were not places and spaces for Black technology entrepreneurs to go to in those days. So we would just pull on resources.
Using your network, right?
Yeah, from wherever we could. It's different now because there are resources for Black and, you know, brown entrepreneurs that just did not exist, particularly for startup, high growth startups. That's one of the reasons why we created Opportunity Hub. My wife has been an incredible advisor in terms of business and finance and structure and negotiations and advice. So I typically don't make a major move. You know, we own our business interests together. So I'm incredibly excited about, you know, the work we've done together.
So, you know, for those who are starting out now in this day and age, what kind of advice would you give them?
Build a product or service that people are willing to pay for and work backwards from there. I think there's a lot of information out there about the ecosystem and how to navigate it and what the resources are. And I think it's incredibly important that you understand how to effectively navigate the entrepreneurial ecosystem, know who the players are in your hyperlocal and national and global industry or supply chain or ecosystem. Make it a point to know their work and what they're building and how you can bring value to them. But ultimately, start a business and see how quick you can get a customer. I think there's been a lot of capital that has flowed to experiential ideation. And, you know, Black entrepreneurs in particular, they don't have the luxury many times of being able to raise capital to fail once and fail twice and then finally get it right. Also, make sure that you're building a product or service that you yourself can deliver. And I think there's been a lot of, if I only had your money, I could go build this. And my question is, well, maybe you're not delivering the right product or service. What can you build and what can you provide? And start there. That is my advice to all entrepreneurs, but especially minority entrepreneurs. Because the data shows it's hard to raise capital. You know, my small check would only get you so far. And I'm only trying to invest my small check if I see a clear path towards revenue and then hopefully ROI. We don't have the luxury to, I know I don't, to have the luxury to just invest in people who want to explore. Right. And a lot of accelerators and programs do because they're well capitalized and funded. But even when it comes to Black general partners or Black venture partners or syndicates, our money is not as long as white money, to be honest.
I want to take it back to your younger Rodney Sampson years. What was that first product that you launched as an entrepreneur?
Well, if you really want to go all the way
back. Yes, all the way back. Was it a lemonade stand? Was it friendship bracelets like Catherine Finney? What was it?
I was a pretty good musician. So I played the piano and organ, and I would play at churches in high school on Sundays and throughout the week. So while other students were, you know, involved in athletic programs, I did a little bit of that, but not really much to talk about. I was somewhere playing the piano or organ for a couple hours and getting paid.
Wow. What age did that start?
I must have been 10 or 11 when I started that. And I got really good at it by the time I graduated from high school. And then when I got to college, I would play in New Orleans to make money. And then I started a party production company called The Best of Both Worlds. And it was called The Best of Both Worlds. And my best friend who pledged a fraternity, this is that, you know, I went to Tulane undergrad, by the way. Yeah. So I pledged Omega Psi Phi. My best friend pledged Kappa Alpha Psi. And so we created a company called The Best of Both Worlds. And we threw parties. We co-owned the club. And that's where we really learned grassroots marketing, guerrilla marketing, which was a big thing back then. This was all pre-internet and email. We were just getting issued emails at Tulane in my senior year. So this was all very, very early, right? Mm-hmm. People still had beepers and not many cell phones were out there at all. So we had to get the word out the old-fashioned way, the traditional media. We didn't have much money for that, but we had a very successful business and club. Then after that, I went to medical school. So somehow I found time to get accepted to medical school, and I went to Penn State. I co-founded a restaurant there that actually still exists. And I co-founded that around 97, I believe, 1997. So that was pre-technology. But, you know, my technology roots go all the way back to getting my first computer in elementary school, where you would code. And then if you didn't save it on a cassette tape, you would lose your code. So, you know, that dates me a little bit. And so
I didn't even know that was an option.
And if you play the tape back in a cassette player, it sounded like a DJ scratching. You got to go if you could hear it. But that's how code was saved. And then you loaded it to a computer via cassette tape.
Wow.
So, well, come full circle, 99, I saw where Mark Cuban had sold Broadcast.com for billions of dollars. And I was like, wait a minute. You know, I had grown up playing the piano, you know, and Hammond organ in churches. And I was like, wait a minute. Churches buy lots of TV time. What if we could build a product that was more affordable but could reach more people? And I was like, streaming media. And so that's how Multicast Media Networks and Streaming Faith was born. And that was my first technology company. I started that on the campus of Georgia Tech with some co-founders in early 99, and we incorporated in May of 2000. And so that's when I went back to my technology roots and kind of combined my relationships in the church world to kind of create an intersectional product that was, you know, software as a service before it was called software as a service. And
so then you sold StreamingFaith.com in 2010.
That is correct. It was acquired in 2010.
Wow.
It was long. And I see now, you know, everyone's sort of trying to build a company and sell it in 3 years. I'm seeing the markets kind of return to that era where it takes 10 to 15 years to actually build something. And I'm seeing the traction takes longer. The monetization takes longer. It just takes longer to build. And So that kind of, you know, let me come in, hit it, you know, build this product and just play the capital game. You know, back to my point, you know, Black people don't play that same game. You know, most people don't play that same game, but particularly Black high growth entrepreneurs are not raising as much capital. And they're also, you know, I have a saying that I say that every Black millionaire should be a billionaire and every Black billionaire should be a trillionaire. If we did not have the same level of institutionalized and personalized racism and bias at every level. You know, you haven't dealt with racism until you are dealing with a lot of money. And people feel like, you know, well, that should be enough for you. You know, you don't need that much in your, that's why our M&A deals are undervalued. That's why acquisitions are undervalued many times. That's why funding rounds are undervalued, because in their minds, in most people's minds, they believe what media has taught them is that all Black people are poor, all Black people live in the ghetto, and if you can just get them out of the ghetto, and it's like, that is not so real. That is not what the average person of color deals with. And so, you know, we want to have the same valuations as any other entrepreneur at every stage of the process. And so it's so much when, you know, it's one thing to say, you know, let's get capital to the community. Okay, great. What type of capital and on what terms? And then what does it look like in terms of the growth trajectory?
Rodney, I have one last question for you. Who are your top three entrepreneurs, startups, or investors to watch and why?
Well, I am amazed at what Arlen Hamilton is doing. And, you know, she literally, some would say she didn't have the pedigree. And I would argue that she is the archetype. She does have the pedigree of a venture capitalist. If she hasn't been on this podcast, you need to get Arlen on this podcast. Just look up Arlen Hamilton and you'll see all of the amazing work that she's doing. A little bit more less profile, but doing some amazing work is Keisha Cash. Impact America Fund. She, under the radar, has been making some amazing investments in high growth tech companies with a social impact lens. And I think she is definitely one to watch. So we're expecting some amazing announcements from her in the coming weeks. So those are two Black female investors.
Definitely, I'll be Googling them after this.
And as far as a founder, Sean Wilkinson, S-H-A-W-N Wilkinson. He's a Morehouse grad. He's working on his second company called Storage, S-T-O-R-J. It's a blockchain company. Sean raised a token sale of about $30 million in less than a week, I believe. And he's killing it. He is probably on his way to being, you know, the Black Bill Gates or something. You know, Sean sent out a letter to the investors and it said, we have 100 years of runway. We were like, no, we don't want you to have 100 years of runway. We want you to sell the company. But, you know, so we've been studying, you know, blockchain and crypto. That's a part of the lab that we launched here at Morehouse, Technology, Entrepreneurship, and Blockchain Lab. We set up a mining server here. And we believe that by launching these chapters, these labs and academies, we will find the next great Black technologist or the next great Black high-growth entrepreneur or investor. We believe that the funnel has to be large enough, you know, if there were a billion-dollar fund. If I had to add a fourth person, which I'll take the liberty there, is Robert Smith. He is the richest Black man in America. He is a technology private equity investor, and he's raising his latest fund. He's raising a $12 billion fund. So you should look at who Robert Smith is. So Robert Smith, Sean Wilkinson, Keisha Cash, and Arlen Hamilton.
All great suggestions. Thank you so much, Rodney. Really appreciate it. If you have anything else you want to talk about before we close it out, please, by all means, the mic is yours.
Well, I appreciate the platform. There are a lot of amazing innovators, entrepreneurs, investors, ecosystem builders, or would-be innovators, entrepreneurs, investors, and ecosystem builders that do not get a platform, and they have an amazing voice. So I don't take it for granted that you would build this platform and that you would invite me to be a part of it. I've been intentional about choosing my words and not just loose talking and just not saying anything to get through the last 30 minutes. But when people listen to it, I want it to be a rubric for them, a guide, a blueprint, or what have you, of how they literally could apply common sense to. And if you sit in a position of power and privilege, you should work to extend that power and privilege to people who have not traditionally had the opportunity and access to, you know, the would-be opportunities that have been afforded to us. We know at the end of the day in the startup world, it's a lot of luck, it's a lot of serendipity, and we can't become too brilliant in the name of luck and serendipity. It's the network, it's people taking risk on our work, and so we should then take the same risk with other investors and communities as well. So thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. Our ears have been wide open this entire time. I appreciate the intention behind all of the words that you have imparted upon us. And if you are ever in Honolulu, please don't hesitate to call us. We would love to meet up with you. Thank you to our guest, Rodney Sampson. Learn more about his organization at opportunityhub.co. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest podcast news and updates at Sultan Ventures. And to learn more about how you can get involved in startups here locally in Hawaii, go to sultanventures.com. Till next time, aloha.